This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is June 4th, 1996. We're conducting, Art Hovey, Warrington, Cole Scott, and I are conducting an interview. We're going to be talking to Fran Myers this morning. This is in the Red Gym. Warrington, do you want us to get the ball rolling?
Yes. Francis, we generally start with a little background spiel. Could you briefly sketch in where you're from and something of your early family relationships?
I was born in Racine, Wisconsin, and have three sisters and one brother. My brother is the father of the famous Dee Dee Myers, who you may know as the president, Clinton's former press secretary.
So it's a political family.
Yes, it always was. We had
it
very
is now.
We always had very lively political discussions among the siblings. I went to St. Joseph's grade school, St. Catherine's High School. And I have to give credit to Sister Monica, who was a great role model to me. She was the art teacher at St. Catherine's, and she was a very beautiful nun, very mysterious, very dedicated to her work, and I think that really influenced me quite heavily. I got a scholarship to a school called Rosary College, which is in River Forest, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, and pursued art there. I remember there was a drawing show that came through that was exhibited at Rosary College from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I looked at those drawings and I said, this is just amazing. I don't think I could ever draw like that, but something good must be going on at that university. And the art department at Rosary, which was a liberal arts women's college, was not very sophisticated. So after much pleading with my mother, my father had died when I was 10, I was allowed to transfer to Madison. It was believed and was taught to us all during high school, in a Catholic high school, that the dialectic materialism ruled in Madison, and it was full of communists and a very dangerous place to go. So there was a certain amount of resistance, but I'm very stubborn and I wore my mother down. So I came to Madison in 1958, majoring in art and art education. That was one of the agreements, that I would have to have a teaching degree when I left so that I could get a job.
Could you digress just a little and talk to the cultural atmosphere in Racine, which, you know, we've talked, so I know it was unusual and interesting there. I'm thinking of the Frank Lloyd Wright influence there, the architecture.
Well, maybe I should fit that in when I start talking about when I worked with the Frank Lloyd Wright images.
Okay.
Racine was a very working class town. It was a blue collar town. Lots of factories. My peers in high school, the boys, for the most part, graduated, didn't go to college, but got good jobs in factories around Racine. That was their expectation to work till retirement and raise a family and have a good life with good pay, enough to buy a house. And unfortunately, I think a lot of industry left Racine about 20 years later, and as industry moved out to the third world, et cetera. So those expectations were fine for a while, but probably in the end didn't work out for everyone. It was a very ethnic town. St. Joseph's Church and School that I went to was a Catholic church and school, and right next was store to us, exactly next door, was a Lutheran school and church. These were the German parishes. There was a Bohemian parish, there were several Irish parishes. Czechoslovakian parishes. So the neighborhoods were divided up very ethnically when I was growing up. And the west side was the Scandinavians, and they had their Lutheran churches and whatever. Part of this I know so well because I played basketball in grade school and high school. And so we would be in a league with all the other schools in town, so we got to know the groups very well.
Actually, you were on a championship team, right? You were
yes.
an athlete.
Yes, Jake's Jerks.
Yes.
That was our gym instructor at St. Catharines, and she was a wonderful person who really inspired us. And basketball was my life during those years, besides art. But it was a very consuming interest.
It's interesting how many of the print people at in the department at Wisconsin were athletes. Mm-hmm. You know, Ray Gleckler, for example, was a football star.
I never would have guessed.
Yes.
Interesting.
What about your family in terms of art? Did they support your art? Were there any artists in the family?
There were very distant relatives that were spoken of in Chicago, mysterious people that were artists. Mainly my mother was musical. She had a lot of musical training and gave concerts when she was a young woman before she had a family. And she had a natural musical talent. And I didn't, but I was coerced into taking piano lessons for many, many years with Miss Hermes, who was, as my mother would say, an unclaimed treasure, and had a very wonderful old house that kind of creaked and wore very old-fashioned clothes, and there was a particular kind of smell of lavender in her house, and one sort of gently opened the door and it was very quiet, and years I would go into my piano lessons, and most of the time unprepared. Occasionally I would have a burst of being good. So it was music that was encouraged in our family, and my cousins were musical, and art was really not considered. And so that's why when I wanted to study art, it was all right if I was trained also to be a teacher.
What sort of art did you do initially? What sort of medium did you use? Was it drawing primarily?
Well, we have to talk about when.
Yeah, when you first started out, before you came to Wisconsin.
Well, the usual basic undergraduate training. The courses that I remember when I transferred to Wisconsin were printmaking. I from the first print off the press loved printmaking. It was sort of a natural thing to me, and very exciting to see the transposition of what happened, things coming out backwards, and sort of all the ways that one could use drawing and painting. I painted, one didn't really have many choices. As an undergraduate, you have lots and lots of requirements to take. I wasn't a very good painter. I didn't really warm up to it. It wasn't right for me, or I didn't pursue it long enough to find out. However, I was, in my graduate years, I did painting equally as much as printmaking, but it was always printmaking that I preferred. I studied with Al Sessler, and the first class that I took was a combination of woodcut and lithography and etching. To my memory, Al was much more knowledgeable about woodcut than the other forms. Etching, we got a very basic knowledge of. Lithography, I guess we did a little color, but not much. The facilities, to back up a little bit, the class, a combined printmaking class, there was one printmaking room, so all these processes were done in the same room, a reasonably sized room. But I remember the stones for lithography being really small, and one couldn't be very ambitious with them. And so I drifted toward etching at that point more than lithography, and then woodcut. I did a lot of woodcut. I really loved woodcut and linoleum, and I worked, at least in my memory, I was in that room all the time working without any need to be pressured, because I enjoyed the medium so much. It was just a total delight to me.
Do you remember which room that was? We were trying to find it the other day.
Oh, that...
It's on the fourth floor of the education building.
It's in the basement.
You were over...
It's in the basement. So that the windows you looked out were half underground, and it was...
There was the one that was upstairs where they were Warrington and Dean used to work. We were trying to talk about the room and education. Fran refers to the room, but she says now it's downstairs, but the one we were thinking of was way up in the corner, fourth floor.
There were two rooms. Mm-hmm. One was Meeker's.
Yeah.
That was up on the fourth floor.
Okay.
And Sessler's was down in the basement, ground floor.
Yes, well, I was here for a summer school so that I could graduate. Having transferred, I needed to have a summer session. So I had to choose between etching and silkscreen. In the old education building, the silkscreen room was on the fourth floor. There was no elevator and no air conditioning, and I chose etching in the basement. So I never did take silkscreen. So etching was my choice. In fact, that summer, Mish Cohn, who normally taught at IIT in Chicago, was a visiting professor. So I had done a little bit of etching work with Sessler as part of this mixed class, but that summer I totally did etching with Mish Cohn. And he's known for a process called sheen collé, where you work really with layered papers and glue, and one can cut out shapes in a secondary paper and put a little paste on the back of it, lay it down on one's plate, and then put the primary surface paper over that, and you have like a collage, but there's print on the collage. The etched ink goes on top of both of these layers of paper. And Mish Cohn has been known for many, many years for that process. He's really gotten very deep in it, and with all kinds of different papers. So I started that summer doing a lot of work with sheen collé, with
Mish Cohn. And he was teaching the rudiments of etching too.
Well, yes, sheen collé with etching.
With etching.
With etching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he wasn't. Of course, he also had a reputation as a woodcut artist and a wood engraver. I think his earlier reputation was strongly in those materials, and I think when he came to Wisconsin, he had sort of recently turned to the techniques that you're describing. And I believe that Meeker worked with him that summer also.
I remember Meeker being in and out of the print shop a lot, and that they were doing sugar lift ground. Mm-hmm. That's another mysterious process. Etching is full of mysterious processes. Where there's a mixture of ink and sugar and detergent that one paints with a brush. When that dries, you put an asphaltum, an acid-resistant ground, paint that over it so that the whole plate is covered. And then when that's put in water, the water leaches through this supposedly acid-proof ground and dissolves the sugar that's under there, exposing the bare metal, which then you aquatint, and you have a positive. It's in many printmaking processes, you have to work around the fact that things get turned around, and what you paint on positively often is acid resistant, and it's the areas around it that the acid can affect. So in order to get a brush drawing, you have to go to great lengths in etching, and this is what they were playing around with. And I remember Meeker had a squeeze bottle full of this, so that he would do kind of drip squeeze drawings. And I think Mish Cohn too. I think that's where Meeker got it, that they were playing around with this method having a very good time.
It's interesting. I think that summer was an important thing because Meeker, of course, with his squeeze bottle, was bringing a silkscreen technique of putting touche in a bottle that you put under the screen. And so he was using that with Mish, who was exploring. At that point, he was still very much exploring the intaglio work. And so I think these two guys from different backgrounds got together and they brought some new ideas into the intaglio mix. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it needs to be said along with this that printmaking was so exciting. I didn't know it as an undergraduate that these kinds of things were new to the medium. I mean, one accepted what one's teachers did as if it had always been done. But you're pointing out, Warrington, that a lot of these techniques were perhaps not new, but were updated and used in different ways. Picasso did an awful lot of sugar lift paintings. Probably about that time.
Now
with a squeeze bottle.
So it was. It was really a very exciting period, I think. That some of the other people have touched on this too.
Mm-hmm.
That there was exploration with the people you were studying with, and then the students latched on to this exploration, and in many cases they carried it further too.
Well,
I don't mean to interrupt.
No, this is fine. This is interesting.
What sizes were you working with in those days? You said the lithograph stones are small. What about your etching plates?
Well, as an undergraduate, they weren't enormous, but they were much bigger. I can think about that. And my linoleum were about like that. And I remember woodcut, you know, we could go to a lumber company and get long planks. So that was very exciting to buy, not ridiculously long, but be able to buy your art materials at a lumber yard. And we used to buy canvas at an awning company. It was all, I think the art stores were certainly not nearly as sophisticated at that point. There must have been the university bookstore, and that was probably it in Madison at that time. So that things like canvas one had to find in the community, or order. I mean, the students used to order canvas from Holland.
You tracked
directly. Yeah, you'd order directly from them. It took months to come, but there weren't the suppliers. I think, you know, a lot of things have changed, and that's one of them that's changed radically. That so many things, there are middlemen who perceived that artists use a lot of different materials, and bit by bit, things were made specially for schools and artists, and now there's an awful lot of things, very sophisticated things available.
Do you remember any of the students that you worked with in that period?
Yes, I was thinking of one this morning, who is Sylvia Solacek Walters. And she also worked with Al Sessler for several years, and particularly was interested in the woodcut, and has been doing woodcut ever since. She is now chair of the art department at San Francisco State University, was also acting dean for a number of years, and deep into administration, and still working in woodcut. In fact, I juried a show at the University of Minnesota in January, a big national show, and was very happy to see some beautiful woodcuts by Sylvia, which I managed to get in the show. I juried this with two other people who were was very competitive jury, so it was great to see her recent work. And so she was a friend of mine in undergrad, and we've kept in touch all these years. We see each other quite frequently, and she has continued to work in the woodcut. very sophisticated reduction woodcuts and figured out ways to do photographic work with the wood block. I'm not sure of her process, but they're quite remarkable, very intricate, and sometimes very, very realistic works.
I was wondering, after you left Wisconsin, after your undergraduate period, you went to San Francisco, didn't you?
I did, yes.
And could you talk a little about the scene there? I think that, again, was a very exciting period. You had the beat movement. Were you a beat?
Or a turnip.
Well, I tried. I wore the costume, which was all black. And I went out with a friend, Sally Hutchison, who was a cohort from undergraduate art school. And we went out and got a great apartment in San Francisco. San Francisco had not been renovated at that time. It was a dingy city, a very real working class city. And the Victorian houses had not been repainted. They were very drab. But there was this corner of San Francisco called North Beach that was very exciting. And we would go practically every night, at least it seems in my memory, and go to the jazz joints and the coffee clubs and meet strange people. We were these girls from the Midwest in trench coats with our black apparel under the trench coats. But I think for a while we stood out until we learned how to behave very coolly and sort of melt into the crowd, which was, one forgets how different the world was. This was the early 60s. People didn't travel, didn't move around the way they do now. And one came from a particular place and had the associations and talked it and looked it from where you were. And then all this people from all over the country sort of clashed together in this small area in San Francisco. And it was, the whole country was really middle class. And when we were undergrads in art school, you know, we thought of ourselves as bohemians, that we dressed differently, we tried very hard to flaunt conventions. So we did our hair differently, we dressed differently, we acted differently, we tried to liberate ourselves from our stolid middle class associations. And so part of this going to San Francisco was to continue this. And the world was very divided up. I'm just not say the world, let's say this country, which is all I knew. Middle class, working class, upper class, and then bohemians. And if you thought or talked or did anything differently from anybody else, you were a bohemian and you were noted, you stood out. People didn't dress oddly crazy as they do now. Everyone sort of wore uniform-like clothes, in a sense. And I remember there was a hairdo at the time I was considering myself bohemian. It was called an artichoke. It was, you know, little tufted curls, and that's what women wore, and that's how they looked. And there was a very uniform look. So this going to San Francisco was just amazing to me. We met people like Timothy Leary. We didn't meet him himself, but there were people like that who had kind of little groups that would hang around and sort of discuss philosophy and think about society and behavior and very much Eastern ideas. There were a lot of people studying Eastern philosophy. We became associated sort of casually with a place called East West House. And Gary Snyder had lived there, and his girlfriend Joanne was living there at the time. Gary was in Japan, was a beat poet. And so the residue of the big beat period was there about 1960, 61. but it sort of was dispersing at that time. Its great period was earlier.
You knew Jack Spicer too, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
He's a beat poet.
Yes.
He had a beat poet.
Yes.
And a very, very good poet who I think died young.
Yes, and there were a couple of others whose name I would have to work at remembering or talk to Sally Hutchison, who was with me in these adventures.
She's more a recorder type.
Well, together we would work, you know, we'd figure out the names. But I remember first finding out at East West House, there was a young Japanese man who was a poet, finding out about the intern camps during the war. And I must have been growing up just totally not unconnected to news, and one didn't, there wasn't television either, there wasn't television news, one didn't, I guess in college I did read Time magazine, but there were a lot of things that I discovered newly that didn't get talked about a lot growing up. Well, I would have been very young, so I, you know, wouldn't have seen the newspapers about all these things, but I remember just being totally almost unbelieving that these things had happened.
Was in this ambiance, was there an effect on your work? Mm-hmm. I mean, were you doing art at this time?
Yeah, we had a big flat, in fact, big flat, rented from one Greg Padilla, a Portuguese, a very nice Portuguese man who ran a frame shop around the corner from us. And so we had a room with our easels in, and I was painting at that time. And later on, I went to the San Francisco Art Institute and took printmaking classes. In fact, one summer, Stanley William Hayter came and taught for the summer at the Art Institute. So I took his class, and that was very exciting. My work coming out of Madison was a little canted toward the German Expressionists, very realistic. And so gradually that shook off during this period in San Francisco, though it did take a while, sort of the way one worked for years and the kind of images one was used to and one was shown in school. It took a while to sort of shake that off. And again, talking about society, how rigid it was, so was art. There was not a lot of simultaneous kinds of image making going on. There was what was going and what was before that. And there weren't like 10, 20,000 movements going on at once like there are now. It's a big smorgasbord about what path you might choose to follow. Well, there was, you know, what we were doing in Wisconsin and the Midwest, and then there was sort of craziness going on in San Francisco. Like Bruce Conner lived right around the corner from us, and he had a gallery where he's very famous now. He's a movie director and writer, and got very well known very quickly at that time in this sort of group of San Francisco artists who became very nationally recognized. And what he was doing at that time was to take dolls and doll parts and macabre things and recreate like a spider web looking thing and make boxes with very macabre things in them and paint everything black. And this was a very wonderful and new kind of thing. And Jay DeFeo, in fact, lived around the corner from me. Her work was recently, in the last 4 months, on the cover of Art in America. She essentially worked on one painting for her whole career, and it got to be thick, 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 thick. And I think the Whitney now has it, and they're going to spend a long time restoring it. But she lived upstairs and around the corner, and we knew about her, and I think we saw her on the street a few times, and hang out with her, but all this was around me in San Francisco, and so one got as my student was saying, you get shit jobs and you go about and do your art. You do anything you can just to make a living. And I remember cleaning test tubes at University of California Hospital. I worked in an import-export firm for a number of years. I worked as a bookkeeper in an antique store. What else might I have done? But anyway, you had a day job. And then you had North Beach and the Beat thing, and then there were the museums and the galleries and artists one met, and also this whole group of people around East West House. And it was very racially integrated group. There were blacks, orientals, and Caucasians from all over the country, and they sort of drifted together in this house where people lived and cooked cooperatively, and we would come over and sort of pay a certain amount and help out with.
That's on tape.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask, and that's where you learned to cook rice. Famous rice cooker here.
That's where we met Jafu Fang. He was a Chinese. I don't know how you could describe him. He was like probably about 40 at that time. And I guess you might describe him as a philosopher. We don't know what he ever did to make a living. But he always had interesting stories and advice to give us about living, and he showed us how to cook rice. Let's see. You put in a cup of rice, and then you put water up to your first knuckle, and with the rice, and then you bring it to a boil, turn it down, and never ever
while
open.
Your knuckle's still in.
Yeah. Well, we hope you've removed your knuckle. because one of the important parts was that you never take the lid off while you're cooking this, ever.
But no peek.
So by that time we were a flat. Emmy Drucker came from Madison. She was originally from New York. Her father was very mysterious to us. He came from a family where politics were very liberal, left-wing, if not communist. So it was so exotic to us to know someone whose father maybe was involved in the early days of communism in this country. And they mysteriously moved to Mexico. Well, what did this mean? Emmy never explained to us why her parents moved to Mexico. We still don't know. Were they forced to leave the country because of their politics? I don't know. So Emmy came out. She had gone to school in history here at UW because of the excellent reputation of the history department. So she came out to San Francisco, and I'm sure we acquired another roommate somewhere along the line. So Jafu Fang was delighted with his coterie of young women whom he could coach and give advice to. So life was like that. People dropped by all the time. One lived not a communal life, but it was a big, broad life that people intermingled a lot, and everybody was doing much the same thing. We didn't have professions or careers as such. We weren't out to make it or out to make money at all. Everybody was out to learn about life and art and other cultures and just to live. I mean, the difference today is so strange to me, to deal with my graduate students who are on a track from the moment that they graduate. There's no one that says to me, I'm just going to go out and live for a while. People don't do that. Our society has become restructured, from this opening that happened in the 60s and late 50s, and the sort of social chaos almost that happened after that. And it's gotten, I think, through the 80s, so regrouped and rigid again.
How would you describe the art that was being produced in San Francisco at that time?
Well, it was awfully various, but it was coming out of of abstract expressionism and back to figuration. Right. So there was Diebenkorn.
So it was in transition.
Yeah, really. There was Diebenkorn.
And the fragmentation that you were talking about, it was evolving.
It was beginning to happen, yeah.
Because I was there earlier, and it was the period when everything was abstract. It was the great period of abstract expressionism, which to a certain extent began at the San Francisco Art Institute with Clifford Steele and the groups there, Hans Hoffman and so forth. Mm-hmm. But in your time, then, this was changing.
It was.
Opening up.
It was. It was. I think Diebenkorn was one of the people who was very, very much looked at by young artists because he was taking the structure of abstract expressionism and bringing in figuration again. And people were very glad to see it. People were extremely intrigued by that. And I think the sort of individual, like Bruce Conners, that was very individual work, not that there weren't historical precedents, but, and then Jay DeFeo, okay, the back to her work, it was an immense image of a rose, an immense image. Layers and layers and layers of paint and plaster until the image became extremely thick. And it changed. There were pictures in this article of how it changed over the years. But she spent, I think, her whole artistic life on three pieces, and the rose was one of them. So that was certainly a different kind of image and a different kind of mental attitude toward making art. Not that we were product-oriented, because selling art just did hardly seem to be something that would happen, or that would be a major thing. I mean, the major thing was making art and thinking about art and experiencing art. I did have a show in San Francisco at a gallery in North Beach, which was very exciting to me. The director of that gallery went on to become a curator at the Whitney Museum. So that was, we sort of kept in touch, our friends kept in touch for many years, and so that was pretty exciting to see that this kid, who I don't think had any degrees, but had a sort of sensibility about art, rose, I don't know what the interim steps were till he was a curator at the Whitney for a while. So I did have that show, and there were some group shows.
Were you mostly painting?
I was painting, and then I would produce prints at the Art Institute.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was painting. Yeah.
You said earlier that when you came there, you were had pretty much abstract expressionism, and then you began to shake that off.
Well, I wasn't doing abstract expressionism, but that was the major art form, the art movement that was acknowledged as the movement.
How did your experiences in San Francisco with the artists and with the bohemian lifestyle translate into your artwork? Is there a way of explaining that?
Well, it certainly loosened me up, but figuration was very strong in my background. So I did not, well, I didn't turn into an abstract painter, but that was moving out at that time anyway. My work was figurative, but the kind of figuration changed. And there was, looking around and sort of I think the structure of abstract expressionism came into the work.
Themes began to emerge there as you later developed explorations of certain ideas, or was this still just trying to get it down?
The theme was still the figure.
Yeah.
The theme was still the figure, yeah. But the way the figure was expressed was quite different. And then working with Hayter, who insisted when you began to work with him that you do a kind of exercise, a technical but also stylistic exercise, which was totally abstract. So that was an interesting maneuver to go through, and I think a very canny device of his. Whenever Hayter had Atelier 17 in Paris, which he'd had for, well, since the war and before the war, and during the war, he had his atelier in New York for a period of 4 years.
4 or 5.
And then returned to Paris, where he ran this atelier, international print atelier, and students would come from all over the world to work there. And he would insist that every student, no matter how sophisticated you were, had to go through this exercise. And I think it was a kind of exercise to clean out and reorient you from your past work. And I think it was, so it's probably some of the abstraction that one had to deal with to do this exercise would translate probably into the design of the work, into the structure, more than being about abstraction.
Now, I was just reading Louise Bourgeois in her big catalog. She describes her work with Hayter, and she had to submit, she had a background in prints, but she went and she had to submit to these little exercises. And she was infuriated. Eventually, she had this hatred for Hayter. In the interview, she really lets loose, and he aroused in her this absolute fury. What was your reaction to Hayter? He was a strong person.
Oh, yes. He was very paternalistic. He was very much a general. I mean, he led the troops. And he had also... you would get promoted in the troops. Because there were several people who took that course that summer who were known as anciens. You were ancients. You had worked with him before. So by the end of the summer, I was an ancien, but I started out as a foot soldier.
What benefits did you get when you were promoted to an ancien?
Well, all along you got certain benefits, little pats.
Little pats, yes. Those are famous little pats.
Yes. he was a very inspiring teacher that summer. I mean, I couldn't have tolerated that kind of structure for very long, but it was very exciting for the summer. And he had a great attack, he had a great love for prints. I mean, this is what you remember about teachers, is not so much what you were doing or what their work looked like, but if they translate that love for the medium you're working in and the love for making art, this is pretty important. So he did that. And he had such an attack. I mean, we use in etching something called a scraper, and it's a three-sided tool that comes to a point, has a wooden handle. But each of these edges that are created by these three sides are very sharp, and you scrape away metal when there's a scratch in your plate. Well, he had made a huge scraper. I mean, normally from handle to tip, they would be about 7 inches. Well, his was probably 18, 20 inches, and it was enormous. And he would take that scraper, put a little tape around it so as not to cut his hand, and use it as a drawing tool and carve right into the metal. And one would classify this as dry point, because you weren't using acid at this point. Clamp the plate down, take this big tool and just go at it. You know, so how could you help but, wow, this is great. So I was doing that. I was doing lots of love dry point and sort of, and then in doing that, my work necessarily became more abstract, because one couldn't control this and draw fine little figures. So that changed my attack. So it was a delightful summer.
So you were deepening your technical knowledge then in San Francisco, as well as all these other experiences.
Yeah, yes. And I also took a course from the regular staff person there who taught etching. Groff, his last name was Groff, okay, who I believe is still there. But he was a much more traditional person, so one sort of went about one's business and wasn't really involved with his teaching much, but it was a place to work. And the Art Institute was full of students who looked, really looked like artists should look. They were sort of They didn't talk much. They kind of grunted and growled, and they looked disheveled, and they wore strange clothes, and there was an atmosphere about that place, and I think there still is, that they were the serious artists. I mean, over at Berkeley, you had the more academic artists. We used to go over to Berkeley. In fact, eventually, I moved over to Berkeley to a more serene life. In the beginning, until the free speech movement started. So things had calmed down in San Francisco.
What sort of visual experiences were they creating at that time, compared with what you've later seen in your own students? Was this group that you refer to creatively fertile, and really somebody that eventually gained reputations beyond just being there or looking the part?
No, I can't think of any people who I knew then, because a lot of my friends were poets and writers. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily visual artists.
Was a big part of the San Francisco scene at the same time.
Yes, it was much more canted that way than for the visual arts. Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti and his...
Yes, well, always at his bookstore. We used to go in there almost every night and browse around and buy little books of poetry. And he was always such a presence. He's a very tall man with a long beard. And right next door to his shop was this place called Vesuvio's. Mm. And it was
still
like
there.
The inn place. And... So you'd meet people. It was a terribly exciting time, just terribly exciting, because you never knew who the people around you were and what their background was and what experiences they had. I mean, we were hungry to get rid of our Midwestern attitudes. So this whole East-West house, there were no visual artists there. They were mainly writers.
You had mentioned that Hayter was inspirational as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
What other... Going back to Madison for a moment and some of your earlier experiences, were there any teachers like Mish Cohen or Sessler that you would put in that same category?
Mish Cohen and Sessler, yes.
Okay. Could you talk about them each for a moment?
Well, there was a kind of, I think I have to say at this point, there were no women on the faculty, there were, except for art education at this point. So there, you know, it was a very paternalistic kind of thing, and I think anyway, as a student at that time, you admired success. I mean, whatever success was, you didn't know exactly, but obviously if these people were professors, they were profoundly valued. So one was a little bit in awe, especially Mish Cohen coming from another school, especially for that summer, and he was also a very, very tall, imposing man. And one wanted to get the most out of this experience, and I think I got terrific critical comments from him, I think more in depth than I had as an undergraduate before, so that his talking to me about my work was very helpful. I think Sessler was a man who liked people and liked to be liked, was not a harsh critic. So one had to be one's own critic, really, with working in his classes. I studied also with Robert Grilley in painting, and that was a good experience. It was good for me at that point, because he is a very realistic, rather academic painter, and so the basics, he really stressed the basics of paint, of learning how to deal with paint, and that was excellent. I was rather impatient. I really wanted to move beyond a kind of controlled approach to painting, which he followed. I wouldn't say he was an influence. I worked with John Wilde, whom I admired very much and I thought was a fine teacher. I took drawing with him. Again, it was very academic kind of drawing. It wasn't expressionistic. It was good for me. I thought it was excellent training, but it wasn't a course that one thought one was making art. One was just learning how to draw. Figure drawing, this was. Figure. So as my interest was in prints, naturally the influence of these people would be in prints. When we first came to San Francisco, Sally and I, we were very deep into the beat scene, but that scene waned a bit, and we grew up a bit, and started thinking about other things. And I remember an exhibition at the San Francisco Museum of Art, and by this time my friend Dolores Valdivia had moved out from Madison, and we went together to an exhibit, a national print exhibit, a juried exhibit, and I saw these prints by Warrington Colescott. And Val said to me, he teaches in Madison now. And I thought they were fantastic prints. So I was ready to move on. The Bay Area was so full of people like me who didn't have any job skills much. I was tired of poor pay, and so I was thinking about what I would do next, and the obvious thing for me would be to get an MFA degree and teach. So I saw these prints, and while I didn't particularly want to go back to Madison again, Val was telling me about Warrington and his work. And so I saw that work and I thought, well, I think this is the person I should study with. So I signed up, was accepted, and went back to Madison to begin graduate school. So, I have to say that Warrington was a big influence on me. I think when you look at our work stylistically, there isn't a great kinship, but there certainly is, again, the love for the medium and the experimental attitude toward the medium, the richness of the medium as in, exemplified in Warrington's work was very inspiring. So I came back and that was I painted as well as worked in prints. I'm trying to think if I did any other print mediums. I think it was just etching that I was doing at that time, and painting. I painted with Hal Lauterman, who was a very interesting person, and was wonderful to listen to about his life as an artist and his experiences in New York and his loft in Jersey. And he would sort of come in and to the painting studios, the graduate painting studios, which were down the street on State Street, under the Oriental Specialty Store, a very nice space. And we all had our little places. We didn't have separate studios, but we had a little place where we put our easel. And Hal would come in and plop down and start talking about life and painters he knew and the scene in New York and the scene in Jersey and how one lived in New York. And got us all excited about going to New York. And also, he was an abstract painter at that point, and so his viewpoint was toward that, and I started painting abstractly at that point. I don't think it was terrifically successful work, but I enjoyed painting. I think he allowed me to experience paint in a different way, so that I could enjoy painting, and which I did, and I did for years afterwards. But I felt my work in etching was more original, that I had a feeling for the medium. And the work that I did in those graduate years, I look at now, and I still think it's excellent work. And I even bring it in and show my students. And they're polite enough not to make any comments, but I think me and etching really clicked. There's something about the medium that worked well with me, and that it was, sort of my ideas and the medium kind of had a race for how we were going to work this out and how this piece was going to happen. I sort of would have an idea and a structure in mind, and then I'd kind of let the marks it was kind of an expressionist attitude toward etching. I mean, I was influenced finally by that movement, by the abstract expressionism, and in the attitude toward making a work, which is you kind of let the work happen, and your subconscious kind of make you move in a certain way. So this was influencing not only my painting but my etching.
Did you were you exhibiting? Somewhere along the line you began to exhibit your work.
Not then, no. Not in school. I think I was too busy finding myself in school. I don't know if there were a lot of juried shows at that time. I know that the other students weren't sending to my knowledge. I don't remember any sort of that thing going on at that point, that people were sending work off to shows. That happened right after I left school. I started doing that. I mean, I had my work. I had the etchings that I did in graduate school, which I did well in shows a little just right after that period. But at that point, I wasn't. After graduate school, I went to London. I lived in London for 2 years. And I picked up teaching jobs at St. Martin's School of Art in London and at the College of Art in Birmingham. Art teaching in the art schools in England was very different than the structure here. Most of the schools, the art schools, were not in universities. And I think that was true in this country too at that point, but that was in larger cities, and in the Midwest they were more likely to be the art departments in universities. So it was a different kind of structure where there wasn't a full-time tenure track going on, except maybe at the Slade, but where schools picked up artists for A class, two classes. Artists traveled all over England to teach a day here and a day there. So I taught at St. Martin's a couple days a week, and then through my connections there, I taught 2 days in Birmingham, took the train up, and stayed overnight with some students at a regular place that I stayed, and then came back to London. It wasn't a long train ride. And this is what artists did. They taught. In fact, I used to take the train up with someone named Dennis Rowan. Now, he was very well known in England. And he was very early into silkscreen. Also, he was a painter and had quite a fine reputation. And this is how, you know, besides some sales, he would support himself by teaching, and this is what most artists did, and it wasn't a steady job, but it seemed to me the pay was really quite good, and it was, you could live on it at that time. So it was a really nice experience being able to teach, and I taught prints, and St. Martin's was a big hot place at that time. Gillian Ayers was making a big reputation as a painter, was teaching there, and I would see her. I wouldn't say I knew her, but I would speak to her, you know, sort of, hello, how are you?
There were prominent sculptors working there. Was that Anthony Carroll?
Yes, yes, whom I didn't know. Yeah. Sort of depended on your day there, who you'd bump into. But mainly I knew the print people. And one of them that I taught with actually made a big reputation painting later on, but I don't remember his name.
Did you have your own studio, or did you use their...
No. Actually, I worked at Birgit Scholl's basement studio, basement print shop, where, you know, most of the people who came to London and were interested in prints would work at one time or another. So, no, I worked at Birgit's, which was amazingly small, but it worked. She taught me lithography. That was the first time that I had done lithography, and continued working in etching, and had an interesting time in London. You know, Birgit used to have what she called dues, and she would have big parties in her basement studio. So you got to meet people from all over and of course lots of print people, because that's what Birgit did. She was a Swedish woman who came to London, oh, probably 10 years prior to the time that I knew her, or more, and loved print. So she set up this studio on Charlotte Street in London, and everybody passed through there. I got to know Michael Rothenstein very well through Birgit. He was a very well-known print artist at that time, mainly in relief prints. So he had a big reputation, wrote several books, and was a very nice man whom sort of appeared at many of Birgit's dues.
What kind of work were you doing by now?
Hard to describe work. Hard to describe what it was. Interiors. It was interiors, rather abstracted interiors, or items of furniture. I think this was my being in London and being exposed to Art Deco. You wouldn't think of London that way, but there are parts of London which are very Art Deco. There are towns in England that parts of them were built all at the same time in a very interesting European kind of Art Deco. So I was assimilating this, and I was looking at this kind of curious furniture that one would see from this period in England. And it was early plywood, a lot of it, you know, when they could make twist and make interesting shapes out of plywood. And that was things one didn't see, that I didn't see exactly in the United States. So that was being noted by my artistic eye, and I was bringing that into my work.